threatening to expand attacks on Beirut again, obviously threatening the airport, obviously threatening the, you know, the usual things that they do civilians, and the United States standing right behind them saying, you know, we are willing to give you a freedom of action, at the same time talking with the Lebanese leaders who are scrambling to put a stop to this in any way. But I feel like in Gaza, like in the West Bank, you as an Arab can do what you want to protect your people, but at the end of the day, if the biggest, the most powerful empire in history is standing behind this genocidal, suicidal nation that is on a warpath, I don't think there's much that you can do, right? And I feel very concerned about what may come next for Lebanon, because now we're hearing, you know, over the weekend there was a rocket attack that was launched from Lebanese soil into a Metula settlement in Israel, and this was used to expand the air campaign. And then we were hearing some reports say that Israel may be trying to essentially do a false flag, right? Justify, dropping bombs in Beirut and just expanding their aggression. Because at the end of the day, they want us to roll over. They want everyone to roll over to tap out and just to say, okay, we will normalize with you. But at what cost, right? And who is willing to do it? What do you guys think about what's happening in Lebanon, about this escalation? Because it's been coming from Syria as well, not just from Israel.
Karim, before I let you go, I mean, it's a one-sided war. Lebanon's under constant attack. We saw attacks yesterday in the south that killed, a citizen. And by the way, guys, just pointing it out there, if someone is in Hezbollah but is not in combat, then it is a civilian. So I just wanted to make that clear to anybody.
These are the rules of war, right? These are the rules
to anyone who was confused about that. So, you know, your stuff doesn't fly with me. Anyway, so we had like very, very, very brutal strikes. They started before this thing happened, where on Saturday, 5 primitive rockets were launched at the Israeli settlement of Umtalle or Metula. And in response, Israel unleashed a heavy wave of airstrikes, like very heavy, on both southern and eastern Lebanon. And Hezbollah, which typically claims responsibility for its operations, denied involvement in this rocket fire. I mean, if you see the photo of the rocket launches, you'll know it's not Hezbollah. I mean, I think it's just agents working for Israel trying to give them excuse, but they don't need an excuse. Again, they don't need an excuse, so not so sure. Israel claimed to have targeted, of course, Hezbollah infrastructure, including command centers and rocket sites, and the death toll is at least 8 people. And of course, they're saying they're doing this to protect their civilians. And of course, the Lebanese state has remained completely silent. You know, no condemnation.
Really?
Yeah, no statements. Oh, you're being sarcastic.
Breaking news.
No, just silence. Silence, you know. For the South, it's like, of course, once again, all these decades later, nothing has changed. The South is treated as though it's not a part of Lebanon. It's totally neglected. And to make matters worse, since the truce was signed in November, you know, Israel's reported it has violated the ceasefire not 1,000 times, not 1,500 times, but thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And, of course, continues to occupy these new 5 strict positions. And Hezbollah has intentionally taken a step back. Hezbollah is not in a great place, is it? Heavily targeted, not given a moment to breathe. Even its newer leaders that have been recently appointed are being targeted one by one. Anyway, Hezbollah has given the Lebanese government and army space to act, standing behind the army and allowing the state a chance to rise to the occasion. But let's be honest, that's leading nowhere. So we are under a one-sided war. And again, it's like, oh, thank you to the government for working to make sure that Beirut won't be hit, because the south isn't a part of Lebanon. We should only worry if Beirut is hit, right? And anyway, this is Lebanon without the resistance, you know? It's a Lebanon that plays into Israel's hands and that seeks complete inaction over justice at any price and, of course, bends to external pressure. Can't even muster up a statement to condemn strikes on its own land.
Currently in Lebanon and previously, and before even the assassination of Sayyid Hassan, Lebanon is either black or white. There is no gray part. You are either with Israel or against Israel. That's it. Previously, the majority or the power that Hezbollah possessed prevented the government to take some decisions such as normalizing, and that's it. And they didn't use their power internally at all. Currently, the power has shifted, but the people are still the same. And the people that believe in retaliation and resistance are still the same percentage as before the assassination of Sayyid Hassan. But what happened now is that the power inside the government shifted, and now the people that are against Hezbollah are acting as if they were the people who fight at Hezbollah, and they are taking decisions against Hezbollah as if they are the ones who won, just to let you know how much the Israelis they are. They are not even Zionists. Zionist is like a very beautiful word for them. They are Israelis. There's no difference. I think they will push for everything, and even the Israelis will tell them, "Khalas, stop," as what happened last month. If you know Arabic and you're following the Lebanese journalists that are aligned with Israel and Saudi Arabia, you will see that they were pushing for normalizations in the media with Israel, and they are preparing the masses. They are saying, if not this week, next week. And now when you go to the streets in Lebanon, you will see, I think the normalization is before the summer. The new school year, you will have normalization.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny part is that the Israelis went out and said, no, we don't want normalization now, because we have parts of your country. We don't want to make a new borders with Lebanon. We are happy as we are.
Yes.
And after that, the journalists and the people that go to the TVs, they stop talking about the normalization, because Israel told them, no, that's not now, babies.
That's not what we want.
Talk about something else. So, in short, there's either black or white in Lebanon. You're either with or against Israel. If you're with Israel, currently you are pushing the narrative of the United States and the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians that everything is blamed on Hezbollah.
Indeed, Lebanon really is, between a rock and a hard place. It's a
By the way, there's a drone. There's a drone now. It came back. It's hovering above Beirut. It's really loud.
That's been the status quo.
For the Lebanese army?
No. It's an Israeli drone.
We saw the Lebanese Air Force a few days ago when they bombed Syria with their World War II planes. Sadly, that is, again, the status quo, that nations need to heal, nations need to be bowed, against the occupier, against the genociders, right?
Guys, this is Hossam. He was only 22 years old. You know him. This is the Al Jazeera correspondent, Hossam Shabbat. So, yeah, he was born in 2001. He's the second journalist they killed today, like within a span of less than 3 hours.
It's been 208 journalists killed.
208, maybe 209 now.
We saw it was one of the NGOs that track attacks against journalists that said a few months ago that the biggest cause of death for journalists in war zones for the past year and a half has been the Israeli army. So again, this is kind of what has become normal, right? And just to finish my thought about what I want to say about Lebanon is that. Lebanon needs billions to reconstruct for the damage that it has already incurred by the attacks, by the Israeli attacks, by the U.S.-backed war. This is money that is being offered, right, by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the Saudis, by the Qataris, etc., by the U.S., I guess. And everything's conditioned. Everything's conditioned, and more likely than not conditioned on normalization. And as you guys said, more likely as Ghassan Kanafani said, right, the neck does not negotiate against the sword. Sadly, that is exactly the position that Lebanon finds itself in. But we will continue to discuss this as the weeks go on. I want us to move to Turkey, a nation we don't often discuss on its own, but that has warranted discussion over recent days, because a huge protest broke out across Turkey, several cities, following the arrest of Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. Over 1,100 people arrested as of this recording, including 9 journalists. İmamoğlu, a prominent figure in Turkish politics, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan's main rival, who could be considered, possibly the next president of Turkey in the upcoming elections in 2028, by the way. So Erdogan really acting way ahead of time to jail his competitors. Turkey at this point finds itself in a very interesting position following the fall of Syria, right? And they seem to have consolidated a lot of power, a lot of importance, in particular, as NATO members. They are in a way the keepers of Syria, no? Of the ISIS government that is currently governing there. And also, an interesting report that I want to mention is that last week the EU, a report comes out last week saying that the EU is apparently reconsidering allowing Turkey into the Union, right, to allow Turkey to become a full EU member. Why? Because they need a new arms dealer. They need to start buying weapons from someone else, because now we know that Europe is on a desperate rush to start arming themselves for their, you know, inevitable war with Russia, now that the United States has essentially left them, you know, standing out in the cold on their own. So all of a sudden, you know, being friendly with Turkey seems to be the correct move for them. So, you know, I just want to give that context to why, right, we are seeing essentially the breakdown of any, you know, democratic pretenses that may have existed in the former Ottoman Empire, to now become more of a, you know, only Erdogan can be in power, only Erdogan can protect our interests, only Erdogan can move forward. So what have you guys heard, what have you guys seen about what's been happening in Turkey?
First, to be honest, I'm not that professional in Turkey issues, internal issues, but of course we all saw what happened. We saw that the mayor of Istanbul was detained, and yesterday he was jailed, yani. They jailed him on
officially, episode. Yes.
Yeah, officially jailed. And we know that the mayor in Istanbul, he was elected by the people of Istanbul. And this is a big difference. Yeah, in our region or in Lebanon, for instance, usually mayors are appointed. But he was elected. That means that the people elected him and they love him for the city. That's why we saw many people went to the streets. But the background story, I read many things. And some people say that because he was... He had his education in Cyprus, and it was revoked. And with him, like 106 people were also their education was revoked. But the point is that, as you said, it's of course it's political. Yeah, if he was from his party, this won't happen, and we all know this.
If he was from the AKP, right? That's Erdogan's party.
So, and the point is that I don't know his ideology. Yani maybe both him and Erdogan is good for the country or bad for the Turkey, but we discuss here what's good and bad for the region. I don't know the stance of the mayor of Istanbul. Do you know about him? Do you know? Yani he's good with Iran. He's good with the United States. He's good with Israel. Yeah, we have to know this before.
I would imagine he's not, you know, a very pro-resistant character.
I don't know, but what's happening here now currently in Turkey, as I see it, as a person who's not like too much into Turkey, this either will make Erdogan the ultimate leader for maybe at least one decade or two decades to come, or it will weaken him. We have to wait and see. And we know that Turkey now has like foots in many places in Libya. If Erdogan is weakened, because this is Erdogan's policy, I don't think this is the policy of Turkey. We have to differentiate this. And of course, Syria will be weakened if he's weakened. Or if he gets the full power, then he can do whatever he wants in Syria, in Qatar, in Libya. We have to wait and see.
Well, like, just to give a bit of a rundown in case there's anyone watching who has no idea. So he was, formally arrested yesterday on corruption charges, but also was previously detained for not only corruption, but terror links, you know, to the PKK. So the court accuses him of everything from embezzlement to rigging bids to unlawful data collection. And he called this like unimaginable slander. And he put out all these things on social media, like, I will never bow down and we will get through this and whatever. So initially, before yesterday, he was like formally arrested yesterday. So he was detained in a dawn raid earlier this week, just as his party, which is the CHP, began endorsing him as a 2028 presidential candidate. So, you know, the timing, you know, says a lot. And so, as you guys mentioned, his university diploma was revoked the day before his arrest. So this sparked what we can safely call the largest street protests in Turkey in over a decade across the country, and they were defying a four-day protest ban that the government enforced. They enforced a protest ban, and of course we saw riot police with tear gas and pepper spray and all that, and you mentioned the mass detentions. But so the point is, many analysts, including those who work with us here at the Cradle, see this as a political purge, you know, of course not a legal process. You know, it's an attempt by him to remove his strongest political rival, I guess, you know, ahead of the election. Because this guy is not, he's more than a mayor. He's like a national symbol of political hope for many Turks.
when he's elected for Istanbul mayor, he defeats Erdogan's candidate, right? The CHP defeats the AKP candidate by like 20,000 votes. And some backroom maneuvering by the governing party in Turkey, which, by the way, Erdogan has been president for 23 years in Turkey. They rerun the election, right? They do it again. And then the second time, he wins by almost a million votes, right? So if anything, this sort of persecution works in his favor. And I would imagine down the line, it's probably going to continue to work in his favor after what happened last week. What I want to bring up to attention, right, is the parallels of what happened, what Erdogan has done over the past week with İmamoğlu, with what happened with Imran Khan in Pakistan, right? When this very popular prime minister is removed from office in a legislative coup, sent to prison, given dozens of charges on everything, right? Just buried in legal cases. Him and his wife thrown in jail. His party is persecuted. His followers are persecuted. It becomes a war, right? In Turkey, it becomes a war against the PTI, if I'm not mistaken. That's Khan's party. In Turkey, it seems to be the same playbook in a way, and because that's the empire playbook, right? This is what happens. This is what lawfare is. This is how you persecute leaders when you don't want to go into a country with marching, with troops, or you don't have an ISIS, or you don't have, you don't want to launch airstrikes and start killing people. You use lawfare. That's what happened in Brazil. That's what happened in Ecuador. That's what happened in Argentina. That's what happened in Pakistan. That's what happens, everywhere. It's been happening everywhere for many, many years. And it's just I think again this idea that Erdogan is their guy, right? He's the guy. He's the guy who brought down Assad. He's the guy who's friendly with Israel. Who's friendly with Azerbaijan. He's the one that is wanting to kind of combat Iranian influence, right? He wants Turkish influence in West Asia, to overtake whatever is left of Iranian influence. And here's actually what's interesting and what I wanna hear your guys' thought about it, because Walla News, this Israeli news outlet, a few days ago comes out with this incredibly interesting report that says that Israeli officials are talking about a confrontation between Turkey and Israel in Syria being inevitable, and that there's preparations going, right, to essentially be a war between Israel and Turkey, which, by the way, Israel and Turkey, they're allies. They've been allied for the longest time. Erdogan and Netanyahu, two peas in a pod. Erdogan will give the loudest speeches about Netanyahu being a Nazi and a Hitler and whatever else. But then there's actually no attempts to break relations, to cut the gas that flows through Turkish pipelines to Israel, to end a trade. Remember when he poses the trade ban and then immediately a few days later starts giving waivers for companies to continue doing trade with Israel. And we have reports at the Cradle about how the trade has essentially not slowed down. If anything, it has increased since the start of the genocide in Gaza. So do you guys think there's any validity, right? Because let's just remember that Israel has been essentially one of the only countries in the world that has been referring to the Syrian government, the current de facto government in Syria, as an al-Qaeda government, as a terrorist government. And they say, too, that they are supported by Turkey, which is, yes, factual, it is. They're completely supported by Turkey. They are, propped up by Erdogan. Is Israel going to go to war with Turkey in Syria?
Not war. I mean, there may be a Turkish threat.
On social media, they will fight on social media.
100%. Remember yesterday what I posted about the Channel 12 correspondent, that he was saying that this is like just a distraction, basically, like Netanyahu has directed the Israeli media to make it seem like Israel's gearing up for a war with Turkey. And this is to distract from, all the internal crises and to be able to continue maybe, everything else that he's doing. So we have a feature, we'll put it up on the screen, by Mohammed Hassan Sweidan from a few days ago, called The Battle Between Greater Israel and Neo-Ottomanism in Syria. So it gives a perspective on the kind of clashing interests between Israel and Turkey in Syria. But, I mean, even through this analysis, a war does not seem likely at all. Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, just maybe people will not understand how is that. How they are talking like this, and there's like institutions who are saying that the war is coming between the two. If you read Egyptian or Jordanian newspapers, you will think that the King of Jordan tomorrow will go and behead Netanyahu. and that al-Sisi will go and like drown the whole Israeli population.
I hope
but
you will place the picture of King Abdullah with the gun. He's cosplaying.
Yeah. So that's it. The media and what these politicians talk is very different of what's happening on the ground. Not only Sisi. Before Sisi, we had Morsi, and we had before Morsi, we had Hosni Mubarak. Especially during Hosni Mubarak, there was, I think, four wars between, or not wars, we can say four aggressions from Israel on Gaza. And in the four wars, Hosni Mubarak refused to open the borders or to accept even people to like get medical care in Egypt. And Sisi, it's the same. Sisi is more smart, I think, because Sisi blamed Israel. He said, oh, look, we wanted to take them, but Israel didn't open the border. Although everybody knows that that Egypt has the authority over Gaza. It's like signed. There's a signed agreement that they have the authority. They can take people in and like open the border. But he didn't. So it's the same.
I just one idea about Israel and Turkey that like maybe this will put things into perspective is, you know, Israel, when there is an existential threat to Israel, Israel will set out to destroy its enemies. In the case of Turkey, there will be no war because there is no existential threat from Turkey. There's competition, and there is like, oh, they might be jeopardizing the current Israel wants its regional dominance to look like, because Israel wants total dominance over the region.
To go back to the beginning of the discussion, right? At this point, Israel has reopened three fronts. They have opened the front again in Gaza, the front in Lebanon, and the front in Yemen, right? Even though the front in Yemen is not being fought directly by Israel yet, it's being just fought by the United States. Before we finish for this week, I just want to get your thoughts on like what is next for Yemen. What can Yemen do next that they haven't done already, right? Because they have already, since the expansion of this war, they have been targeting the U.S. warships, the USS Truman. They have declared Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv unsafe for travel. And they say they were going to continue to launch attacks. They've launched, if I'm not mistaken, at least two Palestine 2 missiles, the hypersonic ballistic missiles towards Israel. Both of them, I believe, shot down. But they're on. At this point, they're on their own, right? I heard also that one of their missiles, the fire actually fell in Saudi Arabia. So, what is next? What is next for Yemen?
As I said last time, Esteban, I think, and people got angry in the comments because I said it, but I think unless they take footage from a drone or whatever, or a footage is leaked that they targeted a U.S. ship, okay, as if nothing is happening in the Red Sea. We only hear the news. And you too. You see that the Yemeni says that we targeted this ship, and then the Americans will have a counter post on Twitter say that they downed the drones or the ships or the cruise missiles. Unless there's visual evidence that this is happening, I think that's it, as if they are doing nothing in the Red Sea. But of course, they are... some of course of the Israeli shipping companies are in pain because they are really targeting them.
And to your point, Karim, about we need footage. I think the biggest victories that Yemen achieved since the start of the genocide in Gaza were, first of all, the taking of the Galaxy Leader, right? This action movie footage of them landing on the ship, incredible stuff. And the other one was the drone that Sima made reference to, which again also had the footage, the social media video of the drone flying in from the beach in Tel Aviv, completely unopposed. So I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, because like I think the title of the last week's videos was very appropriate, the unfinished wars, because this is really like all of this is just gonna continue. I know some of it is falling out of the news cycle. We haven't even discussed about the persecution that anti-genocide protesters are facing in the U.S., in Europe, in other Western nations, the deportations, etc. We haven't talked about Mahmoud Khalil. So many things happening right now, and they're all the repercussion of what? Of allowing a rogue state to continue committing a genocide under the noses of the entire world.
Limelight.
Suppression of dissent in the United States of America is not a new phenomenon. Western regimes will increasingly resort to crude tactics of the type implemented by dictatorships they support abroad, blatantly suppressing dissenting voices. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian graduate of Columbia University who played a prominent role in anti-genocide protests against Israel, has reignited discussions about the so-called freedom of speech in America. This debate is further amplified by Donald Trump's political adversaries, many of whom had supported the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, along with draconian measures against Muslims, both in the U.S. and abroad. Suppression of dissent in the United States of America is not a new phenomenon. In June 2022, Crescent International had predicted that, as the West-centric global order unravels, Western regimes will increasingly resort to crude tactics of the type implemented by dictatorships they support abroad, blatantly suppressing dissenting voices. The primary distinction is that Trump's regime, due to its overt ignorance, lacks the cunning and subtlety of the Obama regime in executing such repression. One particularly telling case that has been largely forgotten by today's self-proclaimed free speech crusaders is that of Tariq Mehna, arrested in October 2009 under dubious circumstances. His case exemplifies the misuse of legal mechanisms to stifle political opposition. An extensive analysis of Mehna's case in the Christian Science Monitor highlighted this stark reality. Quote, a young Muslim male who believed he had the right to express his deep disdain for American foreign policy in the Middle East and Asia. Tariq Mehna, an American-born Bostonian, took his First Amendment rights quite seriously when he vocally condemned his government for killing thousands of Muslims abroad. As a result, he was convicted of conspiring to help Al-Qaeda, unquote. Detractors might argue that Mehna was convicted for being a member of Al-Qaeda. History, however, shows that no regime openly admits to arresting individuals for speaking truth to power. Instead, legal formalities are manipulated to camouflage politically motivated repression. A phrase often attributed to Stalin captures this strategy well. Quote, show me the man and I will show you the crime, unquote. While freedom of thought and speech is indeed more protected in the United States than in regions where Western-backed regimes enforce brutal repression, such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or the UAE, this freedom only extends so far as it does not expose the crimes of the ruling elite. The moment dissenting voices begin to influence political outcomes, the cost of speech becomes evident. As it becomes increasingly clear that Western powers, particularly the U.S., are being relegated to mid-level status in global affairs, their reaction to alternative viewpoints is only set to become more aggressive. The United States, as the principal hegemon of the Western world, has the most to lose from this shift and is therefore likely to lead the charge in brutal crackdowns on dissent. Two major factors will exacerbate political and social turmoil in the U.S. as Washington's tolerance for alternative views continues to erode. Zionism and the inherent idealism of ordinary Americans. The Zionist lobby now fully understands that a growing number of Americans perceive its influence over U.S. politics as a direct threat to their sovereignty. Recognizing that they are becoming increasingly cornered, Zionist interest groups have chosen to double down on their efforts to suppress critics, an approach clearly evident in the case of Mahmoud Khalil. However, this strategy has led to a paradoxical situation. Regardless of one's view of American society, it remains fundamentally idealistic. This deeply ingrained idealism will inevitably generate a strong backlash against Zionist attempts to weaponize laws against influential political activists and outspoken critics. Ironically, the Zionist greatest adversary may be none other than Donald Trump and his circle of loyalists. Through their crude and heavy-handed critics, they may inadvertently serve as catalysts for mobilizing the American people against Zionist influence in the United States of America. Given Israel's excessive dependence on U.S. backing, a significant shift in American public sentiment poses an existential threat to the Zionist project. The unraveling of the Western order is not a passive process, but an active battleground. No repressive empire is dismantled without cost and sacrifice. Washington's response to America's imperial decline will determine whether the United States can adapt to a multipolar world with some degree of stability or descend into a state of decline, reminiscent of the Soviet Union in late 1980s.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Sudan conflict continues to devastate the nation, drawing global attention, with the Sudanese government accusing the UAE of supporting RSF rebels. The stakes have never been higher. Now, as we approach the third year of this conflict, we ask, what lies ahead for Sudan? The military intervention of the United States in Somalia began in 1992. Fast forward to today, and we see ongoing involvement, including recent airstrikes from the Trump administration. While the U.S. asserts that it's battling terrorism, the reality is that terrorists still roam the country unchecked. So, what is the true objective of the U.S. military intervention in Somalia? And to discuss how the U.S. is meddling in Somalia, we have contacted Abdul Latif Ahmed. He is a journalist, research lead, and a digital news editor. And for more on the devastating war in Sudan, we are joined by Meki El-Moghrabi. He is an African affairs analyst and a former diplomat. Stay with us for this week's edition of Africa Today. The Sudan conflict, which erupted in April 2023, continues to devastate the nation, drawing global attention. The war pits the Sudanese armed forces against the rebel rapid support forces, RSF, now designated a terrorist organization by the Sudanese government. Sudan accuses external actors, particularly the United Arab Emirates, of fueling the conflict by supporting RSF leader Mohamed Dagalo. Now, this involvement has further prolonged the violence, deepening the crisis. The humanitarian toll is staggering. Over 30 million people urgently need aid, with 15 million displaced. Women and children bear the brunt, facing heightened risks of violence, malnutrition, and exploitation. The destruction of critical infrastructure has left education in ruins, while famine spreads across the country. The future of Sudan is uncertain. Where is Sudan headed as the conflict nears its third year?
Sudan's proxy war.
The Sudanese army remains resolute in ending the war. Recently, the army seized full control of the presidential palace in downtown Khartoum in what is seen as a major gain in a two-year-old conflict with the RSF rebels. The military spokesman speaks here after the victory.
Our forces today crowned their successes in the capital, where they were able to crush the terrorists in the areas of the center of the city, the Arab market, the buildings of the presidential palace, the symbol of the sovereignty, pride, and dignity of the Sudanese people.
Sudan's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Al-Harith Idris, recently stated that the war in Sudan will not stop unless the United Arab Emirates halts its support for the RSF rebels or terrorists. He said the UAE is shedding the blood of the Sudanese people and killing them with the aim of controlling Sudan's wealth and resources. Now, Mr. El Moghrabi, is this sentiment shared by most people in Sudan?
Yes, it's true. And by the way, this is the stand of Sudanese people. What is said by Ambassador of Sudan in the United Nations represents all the Sudanese people. And all the people are waiting for the Sudanese representative all around the world to say the same. And I believe now there is a room for diplomatic talks and negotiation between United Arab Emirates, but they are losing time and they are creating some fake news media, websites, and social media accounts, and they want to portray for the people that other Sudanese are saying different things from what is said by the ambassador of Sudan in the United Nations or by the Sudanese people, and that will not work. The Sudanese people now, all of them together, are united against the aggression of United Arab Emirates.
Last February, the Arab League voiced strong opposition to any steps that could threaten Sudan's unity or lead to its division. Despite the statement, Arab countries have been criticized by the Sudanese people for not taking enough action to stop UAE support for RSF rebels.
The majority in the Arab League, the countries are against the United Arab Emirates aggression on Sudan, against the parallel government that is created by United Arab Emirates. By the way, it is not something real up to now, the what so-called parallel government. They couldn't make it. There is pressures on Kenya not to do it. Until now, it is not declared in Kenya. And they want to make it as something real, and it should happen. And but now in the region, Uganda against that, Djibouti against that, Somalia against that, Ethiopia against that, Eritrea against that. Chad now started to negotiate with Port Sudan, and they want to stand against the RSF. They want to change their position, by the way, the Chadian government. And that because of the insecurity that started to happen in Chad, based on the soldiers that they flee the war in Sudan from RSF, and they want to create their own militia inside Chad. Anyway, the Arab League and the other organizations will not accept, will not recognize the what so-called parallel government.
Recent reports indicate that the United States and the Israeli regime have approached Sudan, along with Somalia and Somaliland, to discuss the possibility of resettling displaced Palestinians from Gaza. This proposal has sparked significant controversy and backlash. Why is the Trump administration toying with this dangerous idea of forcefully moving Palestinians out of Gaza to Sudan amid a deadly conflict in this country?
The Sudanese Minister of Foreign Affairs, he said that we didn't receive offer from Israel regarding hosting people from Gaza inside Sudan. The Sudanese position is against dismantling the Palestinian issue or the Palestinian country and the Palestinian nation by taking them outside their lands. And that is has been said firmly by the Sudanese Minister of Foreign. And he said that we didn't receive the offer. It's just something on the media. Maybe that's just they want to start discussing this with Sudan. They want to make pressures. But I think the Arab stand and the Islamic stand is against such a step.
The humanitarian situation in Sudan will be catastrophic if peace is not attained. Efforts to resolve the Sudan conflict through negotiation have faced significant challenges, and the people continue to suffer. The prospects for peace in Sudan remain challenging, but not entirely out of reach. So is there hope that the conflict approaching its third year will end soon?
Yes, it is a very bad situation. Homes, their houses are robbed, and no electricity, no water. But the public opinion saying that we go there, whatever happened. Sudan is not a cold country. By the time of Eid, it will not be winter in Sudan, and it will be part of the summer, so that people can manage their lives. And we lived part of our lives with water shortage and energy shortage, and we know how to manage that by local solutions. So that people of Sudan and people of Khartoum are back, and they will go to their homes, and they will not stop the life. And yes, we need support from friends, but this support, if it has political condition, we will not accept it.
Well, thank you very much, Meki El Moghrabi, for your insight. Indeed, we look forward to the restoration of peace and prosperity in Sudan. Stay with us for the next segment of our program on how Trump is meddling in Somalia.
Trump meddling in Somalia.
Listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. military intervention in Somalia, initiated in 1992, continues under the pretext of war on terror. Recent airstrikes during the Trump administration have faced criticism for causing civilian casualties. Critics argue that these actions exacerbate instability allowing terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab to thrive. At the same time, influential Republicans, including Congressman Scott Perry, are advocating for U.S. recognition of Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland. Now, this aligns with Project 2025, a roadmap prepared for implementation during the Trump presidency. Such a move raises concerns about U.S. intentions to balkanize Somalia, potentially using Somaliland as a counterbalance to diminishing influence in neighboring Djibouti, where China's presence is growing. Meanwhile, African Union troops in Somalia lack the resources to effectively combat terrorism and restore security, creating a pretext for the prolonged U.S. presence. Now, in a startling development, reports suggest that the U.S. and the Israeli regime plan to relocate Palestinians from Gaza to Somalia and its breakaway region of Somaliland. Now, this raises a critical question. Is the U.S. genuinely fighting terrorism in Somalia, or are there hidden motives behind its involvement? The U.S. Africa Command conducts numerous military operations across the continent targeting alleged terrorist groups. Yet, despite these operations, terrorism is on the rise in Africa, and countless innocent civilians are losing their lives due to these U.S. actions. The so-called war on terror by the U.S. in Somalia has been going on for decades, but terrorists still roam freely in the country. Mr. Ahmad, what exactly is the U.S. military doing in Somalia?
The U.S.'s presence in Somalia is merely a pretext because the involvement of the United States has spanned over three decades, and it has little to do with terrorism, the fight against terrorism, as the case may be. What we have seen over time is an attempt at geopolitical dominance in the Horn of Africa, and Somalia's strategic position along the Gulf of Aden is offers it as a critical global shipping route. And the United States' presence there is essentially to be present, to, you know, under the guise of counterterrorism, to basically deploy its drone, its military operations, to ensure that, you know, the U.S. has a strategic hold on that region.
Key Republican figures like Congressman Scott Perry are urging official U.S. recognition of Somaliland, a self-governing region of Somalia, as part of the conservative Project 2025 agenda for a potential future Trump administration. The Heritage Foundation-led strategy singles out Somaliland and Djibouti in its African policy, implying recognition could counterbalance America's reliance on Djibouti, home to its sole permanent military base in Africa. It raises concerns that the so-called war on terror is merely a pretext, suggesting that the Trump administration may have plans to balkanize Somalia.
The push by the U.S. Republicans to formally recognize Somaliland is a clear indication that Americans' interest is not about stability, but strategic fragmentation. Divide and conquer, the more you have smaller units to interact with, the easier for you. So, you know, by endorsing the Somaliland, there's a tendency that the U.S. is employing the same divide and rule tactics of Western powers, historically weaken African nations. What you would also notice is that by recognizing Somaliland, which is generally more peaceful as compared to Somalia, it will serve as a counterweight against China's presence and influence in neighboring Djibouti. Beijing has established a significant military presence in Djibouti and economic presence.
African Union troops have been deployed in Somalia to combat the rise of terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab. Now, their success hinges on support from other African nations and also the United Nations. However, the military capabilities of the African Union mission are limited, providing a rationale for continued U.S. military presence in Somalia. Now, is the weakening of African Union forces in Somalia a deliberate strategy?
There's no doubt that the underperformance of AMISOM benefits the United States and any other external body because it creates a justification for Washington to maintain a military foothold in Somalia. you would realize that African-led peacekeeping efforts are being intentionally underfunded and undermined because it ensures that Somalia remains perpetually reliant on external military assistance. And a stronger AMISOM will definitely, you know, backed by genuine African cooperation and support from the AU and African states, will render U.S. intervention unnecessary. U.S. will not be needed, you know, on African soil. But what you realize is that this does not align with the long-term agenda of the United States, which thrives on the instability and dependency. So African nations must figure a way to get real security, to ensure that Somalia is able to stand on its own, have its real security, and is able to achieve this through self-sufficiency and, you know, regional solidarity.
The federal government of Somalia has categorically rejected reports that it is holding talks with the United States and the Israeli regime Israel on forcefully moving Palestinians from their land in Gaza to Somalia. Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland has also denied holding talks on the same issue. A Somali politician says the country will not be accepted.
As an independent politician, Somali politician, I don't think that we'll get the unanimous support of the Somali people, be it people, I mean the population or the government.
The fact that such a report on ejecting Palestinians from their land and moving them to Somalia has leaked indicates that there is more than meets the eye in America's military presence in Somalia. Now, what do you make of this dangerous plan?
The leaked reports on the alleged U.S. and Israel's plan to resettle displaced Palestinians in Somalia raises serious concerns, you know, about America's broader agenda in the region. While the Somaliland and Somali federal government has denied these reports, there's a chance that there are underhand dealings, there are backdoor dealings to ensure that this happened. It indicates that there's an attempt to undermine Somaliland and Somalia. There's also an attempt to disregard Palestinians because they have insisted to not be resettled elsewhere.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up, but we shall keep you posted on U.S. plans aimed at destabilizing Somalia and other African countries. I would like to thank Abdulatif Ahmed for his incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. From me, Mubarak Kenya, and the entire crew, it's goodbye for now.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 26, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of university students and academic personalities on the 24th day of month of Ramadan. When when it is said that the elimination of ideology is necessary in the country, this means that the intellectual identity of society, whose important manifestation is universities and students, has to be destroyed. The elimination of identity means this. It means that the philosophical principles and the historical and national viewpoints of a nation should be humiliated. Their history and that of the revolution should be humiliated. The big feats that have been accomplished should be played down. Of course, there are some shortcomings, but these shortcomings are magnified 10 times. This is what the elimination of identity means. Then, Western philosophy must replace this identity. An example of this attitude is the American 2030 education agenda, which is an embodiment of the domination of Western neocolonialism in our age. This is one of the manifestations of it. Thanks to the revolution, the great legacy of thinking and culture was revived in the country. This has to vanish or be undermined. This is the goal of the enemy. Today, we have tens of millions of youth in the country who are ready to climb the peaks. That is, today, the youth of our country are really ready, some of whom have religious and revolutionary motives, and some may not have religious and revolutionary motives, but they are prepared anyway. They are prepared to launch a scientific movement and climb the summits of glory and national dignity. According to the enemy, these youth must become dysfunctional and disappointed. They must turn their backs on the peaks, and they must stop appreciating the path taken and blow a breath of cold and poisonous air in the trumpet of despair and render other youth hopeless as well. Today, this is being done. Therefore, we must stand up against this. One must stand up against it. When you come here and speak with an exemplary courage and power, we really enjoy this power of eloquence, this enunciation, and this solid rationale. They want to discourage these sentiments with temptations. They intend to inject a sense of dead-end situation in youth so that they feel that nothing can be done because there is an impasse and all efforts are futile. This is what is being done. This is the effort to destroy identity.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In Al-Katiba area in northwestern Khan Yunis, which is included within the so-called safe zone and not far from the infamous Al-Mawasi area, last night the families inside this neighborhood were sleeping and suddenly a massive explosion happened that